We all take risk in the oil and gas industry. There's no doubt about that. But we also have to hedge those risks. The newest addition to the faculty at one of Fort Worth's oldest universities, Texas Christian University, knows a thing or two about that. We'll talk about that, his journey, and much more on this episode of The Crude Truth.
In 1901, at Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, the future of Texas changed dramatically as, like a fountain of fortune, thousands of barrels of oil burst from the earth towards the sky. Soon, Detroit would be cranking out Model Ts by the millions, and America was on the move, thanks to the black gold being produced in Texas. Now, more than a century later, the vehicles are different, but nothing else has truly changed. Sure, there may be many other alternative energy sources like wind and solar and electric. But let's be honest, America depends on oil and entrepreneurs. And if the USA is truly going to be independent, it has to know the crude truth.
This episode of The Crude Truth is brought to you by Oil and Gas Workers Association, Sandstone Group, Air Compressor Solutions, Basin Fluids, and the Fuel Pros.
Well, I am just too excited today to bring on a guest that is here in Texas. We've brought another great person from another country, I think, to the great state of Texas. He's from Oklahoma. I've got to look down at my list real quick just to name off the accolades. 30 years in the natural gas industry, including physical and financial commodity training, sales, and transportation storage services, risk control, gas purchases and sales, business development, and interstate pipeline commercial operations. Oh, and he's also been teaching on the side for the last 30 years. My guest today is Tom Singh. Tom, how are you?
Good, Ray. Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for coming on today and representing not only a great institute, which is the Texas Christian University, but also the oil and gas industry in general. I just think what you've been able to do and how many people you've been able to teach and show so many different things of real world aspects over the last 30 years is just amazing. So thank you so much for coming on, and shout out to your boss, Ann, for allowing you to come on today as well.
Yeah, most definitely. And I'm here because of Dr. Ann Blunzer.
She's a nice lady.
Yeah, very much so.
And she's tough, too, to what I understand.
I haven't found that yet.
That's a rumor I've heard. I don't know, but that's a rumor I've heard.
She gets things done.
Yes, she does. And you just joined the faculty there at TCU at the
Ralph Lowe Energy Institute.
Yes. And how's that going? I think you've maybe only had one day so far of teaching.
Today will be my first classes, but okay. I started a week ago Monday, and so I'm already drinking from the fire hose. A lot going on there.
Okay.
When Ann and I spoke last summer about this opening, you could tell she had a lot on her plate and needed some help. So now my plate's starting to fill up.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, I want to talk about you and just what you've been able to do. In my little tease there, we talked about hedging, and you've written a book here recently. But also, I'd like to kind of build up to that and talk about your journey for the last 30 years as I condensed it down there in that opening.
Sure. Yeah, I started in pipeline operations. I actually worked shift operating a natural gas pipeline, which, I look back over the years, and that was an invaluable experience to understand actually, the mechanics of a natural gas pipeline. We went out in the field, worked with those guys, but I learned where the supplies were coming from, who the end users were. So over time, then I was basically attractive to marketing companies.
Okay.
So I got pulled away, started doing physical marketing of natural gas, mostly in the Mid-Continent region. Later on, financial. So I bought and sold natural gas liquids, condensate quite a bit throughout my career. But to your point, the financial aspect, I did a lot of hedging. I ran a pretty large hedge book for a midstream gathering processing company.
Mm-hmm.
As you were mentioning, to minimize their risk. I was asked by a friend to teach a class at the University of Oklahoma starting back in 2000 on, actually back then we called it natural gas marketing. They didn't have anything like that. So I was an adjunct there for 7 years. That gentleman brought a program, what had been energy management at OU, and convinced the University of Tulsa to have a business degree undergraduate program. So he formed an energy management program up there. I taught there for about 7 years in adjunct, and then they asked me to come on full time in July of 14. So the past 8.5 years, I was at the University of Tulsa.
Yeah, they're in that other country just north of Texas. Yeah. Oklahoma. I've heard of that place, you know. And although I will say this, the Big 12 has some big work to do ahead of them. But that's sure. Another channel station we can talk about.
They call Norman? UT Norman?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Well, you know, your career has now brought you to the great city of Fort Worth and the even greater state of Texas. And what you're doing over there now at the Ralph Lowe Energy Institute is teaching two classes. What classes are you teaching over there?
Well, if you understand the process in academia, the energy related classes I was teaching before have got to be approved. Okay. So Dr. Blunzer and I work on that this spring so that I'll actually be teaching energy content courses in the fall. Okay. In the meantime, the way they do it is I report to Dr. Blunzer as an employee of the Energy Institute, mm-hmm. but as a faculty member, they put me in the Department of Finance. So for this semester, I'll be helping out there teaching some intro to finance classes.
Okay. And, you know, when you talk about intro to finance classes, you know, your book is Energy Trading and Hedging, a Non-Technical Guide. And I don't know how you can do anything non-technical when you just talk about hedging and trading. I mean, I was looking over and I was able to peruse a little bit about that book. And I tell you what, you really go into some pretty, pretty good detail in a non-technical way. I tell you what.
Well, I appreciate that. It evolved over years of teaching it. And I finally, I thought, well, wait a minute here. You know, my lesson plan throughout the semester started to me to look like chapters in a book.
Okay.
So I approached Penwell Publishing. They wanted less of the actual logistics and value chain type stuff and more of the financial derivatives. Right. So because it was a textbook to be used in the classroom, it's written as though you know nothing whatsoever when you pick that book up. So I try to use really good examples. For instance, options are a very, very complex financial derivative.
Yes.
But what people forget is anybody who has car insurance has a form of an option, right?
Really?
You have that, sure. If you pay a premium, correct?
Okay.
For a certain period of time and you get certain coverage with a certain deductible.
Yeah.
If you get an accident, what do? You call your insurance broker.
Okay.
So it's a type of call option. Well, your maximum exposure is whatever your deductible is.
Huh.
So the year your policy expires, you paid your premiums, you didn't have any accidents, options expire worthless. It's the exact same thing in energy, commodity options, and stock options.
Really?
So you try to do the things that people can relate to understand the more complex comps. That's why it's kind of called non-technical.
Okay. Yeah. No, I just learned something new. I mean, I'm not I'm not one of those guys that does the Wall Street stuff. You know, I've watched the movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. That's probably not even a good way to understand how Wall Street truly works. Okay. But when you're talking about it, you got the NYMEX, which is the New York Mercantile Exchange.
Right.
And on there are what? All the commodities, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. You really are dealing with four main energy commodities. So these are futures contracts.
Yes.
It's the right to buy or sell a certain commodity in a future month at a given price agreed upon. There's a set volume. So for instance, crude oil is West Texas Intermediate crude oil, right? That's the light sweet. And it's the FOB is Cushing, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. which happens to be the world's largest crude storage facility. And so right now, for instance, they're trading for February, for March, for April delivery in the futures markets. So these are legally binding. It's a formal exchange. So then they also trade natural gas at Henry Hub in Louisiana. They trade unleaded gasoline in New York Harbor, and they traded what's known as ultralight sulfur diesel in delivered in New York Harbor as well. So those are the key energy ones. And so when people say, you know, you pick up the Wall Street Journal, you hear in the news, the price of oil today was $81.60.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's $81.60 right now for February 2023 deliveries at Cushing, Oklahoma.
Wow. Okay. So we're already looking at 30 days ahead in the price right now.
Essentially correct. Okay. Right. You trade in the current month for the next month. So about a week from now, you will see that the February WTI contract will expire. So everything will be done for that month. And then they'll just move on to March. So again, but the idea is it's in the future. It's not happening tomorrow. You're not buying crude oil for next week. It's commitments for the following month.
And yet for me, I get paid 30 days after my oil gets picked up, you know? And so I guess that's a whole 60 days span in there that, that the price really changes during that time frame. Now, of course, I'm getting paid the price when the day it gets picked up, but hey, I'm still not getting that for 30 more days, you know, on average.
You know, no, you're exactly right. Job. Sure. You, yeah. But the idea is, and hedging can be controversial.
Oh, yeah.
There are people who say, no, I'll just, you know, I'll just roll the dice. And my gosh, you look at the last 18 months, you know, why would you lock in some of these prices? It's been right. pretty crazy, but because the lows have still been higher than we saw 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
And so but it's a business decision. Mm-hmm. You have to admit, if you produce anything, I don't care what you make, mm-hmm. you produce anything and there's a market for which you could set a price and therefore guarantee a certain amount of earnings. If you don't do that, you are speculating. Yeah. I mean, it's 100% gamble. Then you'd I'll just ride with the market. So it's a business decision. The entity has to say, we want to do this. And then you go into those markets and if you're a producer of oil, natural gas, you forward sell and you lock that down. So regardless of what happens now, sure. Here's the issue that I always find funny. So let's just say today I sold some February crude oil for $81.50.
Okay.
Yeah. I locked it down. Okay, great. My lifting cost is $40. Boy, look at me, you know, $41. Exactly yeah. right. Tomorrow, if the price on the NYMEX goes to 82 or 83, people are going to say, oh, Tom, you lost money. I can't lose money unless I sell my oil for less than what it costs me to produce it. But there's a perception that, oh, yes, you know what? Technically speaking, I left money on the table.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But what if tomorrow it dropped to $79.50?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So there's a lot of misconceptions about that. It's like people with second, that's the problem with hedging. You
okay.
get second guessed all the time. Even though it was a business decision at the time, you said, I want to do this. I want to lock in a price. Therefore, locking in profit margin, because you know what your cost to produce is,
yeah.
right? If it goes above that, people, oh. But the other way, nobody says, oh, you're a hero. You know, you look at you, how smart. And it's no crystal ball. It's a no. business. You go to the market and you see what the market will give you. Yeah. And if it works for your business, you do it. To me, because I've done it so many times, it seems simplistic to me. I know it's not to a lot of folks,
yeah.
but it becomes a business decision.
Man, that oil and gas commodities market is a fun place. It's there's a lot going on in there.
Well, it's ridiculously volatile. You know, that's the part of the problem. So, you know, the commercial entities, the physical people in this industry uh-huh. whose livelihood depend on it, they may not like the volatility, but it's about what will the price give you as an opportunity for your business. One of the things that I don't think people understand necessarily is high frequency trading. These are companies that have multi-million dollar supercomputers mm-hmm. and they have these quantitative analysts who write these algorithms and they're out there trading. These computers are trading.
All day. Okay.
While the market's open. No, the computer itself.
Right. But yes. Would it be considered one of
yes.
those? Okay.
Yes, it is. And right.
They're doing that.
For instance, let's talk about West Texas Intermediate futures on the New York Mercantile Exchange. They're out there. Every contract is 1,000 barrels equivalent, right? Yeah. These computers are out there executing thousands of lots in nanoseconds. So this volatility that we see is really, truly driven. If you look at the volume of contracts that trades, the volatility we're seeing, in my opinion, is really being pushed by these so-called algo traders or high-frequency traders. It's so important to them, the speed of the transactions, that what they do is it's called co-location. So if you want to trade NYMEX futures, you want your supercomputers to have a link like within a block of the actual exchange itself. Because let's say I'm sitting here in Fort Worth, even yeah. with my supercomputer, and I'm trying to get trades executed, the folks in New York are within a few blocks of the exchange. That nanosecond difference
makes
all the difference.
Wow.
So you'll see something will happen, a piece of news will come out, and the move, whether it's up or down, gets magnified. So that it amplifies it because of the volumes. Likewise, like I said, if some news came out, let's say that was some kind of a bearish news came out today, mm-hmm. and if these computers start selling off, yeah. it's tremendous volume. And the computers aren't saying, oh, well, the Saudis said that they're going to increase their output. No, the computer is looking strictly at the prices that are happening, and then they react, start to go down. And so they magnify these moves. So as human beings, we're really kind of observers, kind of stand back, go, okay, this is what's happening. But again, it's a free market system. The market moves up and down. You get in and out when it makes sense for you to get in and out yeah. from a business perspective.
Well, you know, I'm glad, you know, I was just thinking here as you're explaining the way the market works, that sometimes you get asked a question, if I'm doing like a radio interview on, hey, why is the price of oil so high? Why is the gasoline so low today? It's like, we're at the mercy of the market. It's like, you know, as much as I wish that I could throw so much more, you know, so much more supply on the market, or if Exxon has a good day, or if Pecos Country Operating has a great day, you know, it's still New York City and that mercantile that's still really affecting the price of the barrel of oil. Is that?
Yeah. And really it's more of a, you can almost look at it as, I mean, it's like 95% electronic trading now. So you can almost look at it, it's the black box into which all this data goes globally. I mean, so let's face it, right? So you have the OPEC Plus group, right? They call it a cartel. That's market manipulation. Mm-hmm. That's out and outright price fixing, right? Yeah. They say, oh, we're going to increase output, or we're not going to increase output. But when that signal gets to the marketplace, let's say myself as a trader, I might get a piece of news and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, for instance, just the other day, the Department of Energy has stopped making sales out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Yes.
Right. So they've been doing it for a long time. So the market said, okay, wait a minute. That means that there's going to be less supply coming in the marketplace. Prices are up today on that factor, and the fact that China, we're still not sure how their reopening is going, but they are reopening. They're not where they were a month ago. So you're looking at, okay, it looks like China's going to increase their demand. At the same time, the SPR is not going to make sales anymore. Bullish signals in the marketplace. Absolutely. So traders start to jump in and they start to buy it up. And like I said, this is where then these computers are just, they see a price, boom. And the idea is they're executing in nanoseconds. So let's just say, I mean, it may be a nickel, but they've done 10,000 contracts, you know, and then they get out. And then they watch if it continues up, they get in, they get out. I mean, it's to your point, it's not just day trading. It's like intra-second trading.
I didn't want to.
No, you're exactly right.
Okay,
it is.
I didn't want to belittle it, or I just.
Oh, no.
Because your book, again, I want to say it again, Energy Trading and Hedging, and not it, it really explains a lot. And especially for someone like me that, hey, you know, I go get my oil, I produce it, I make sure it gets on a truck, and I make sure that guy hands me a ticket, and that is gold right there. Because if the ticket doesn't match the check, then we got a problem.
Right.
Okay. And it's the check with that dollar amount per barrel that is going on in New York City. And so there's so much that goes on. And so really, so much goes on between that mailbox. When people call about oil and gas and investing, they call it mailbox money. And it's sure. Do you know what goes into that walk from your front door to the mailbox to get that check?
Very good. I like it.
So I've really enjoyed it. Hardback too. It's a hardback book.
Yeah.
It really explains a whole heck of a lot. And for me personally, it's really helped me out. I read a book by the late T. Boone Pickens called The Second Billion Is the Hardest, or The First Billion. And he talks about Mesa. His company Mason, how they did basically this type of a deal. Now he doesn't talk about the computers and stuff, but he talks about that it's 1,000 at a time.
Exactly right.
And he was able to do real well, and smart man, the way he was able to also donate millions to OSU and then had them invest in this stuff over here. Genius, what he was able to do.
Sure.
To
your point, you know, and I think, you're getting paid for oil. The question is, well, the starting point becomes Cushing, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And then you've got transportation, as you know, you've got specification differences, you know, deducts and things of that nature, but it's all going to come around to where's the starting point. It's Cushing, Oklahoma. And then, you know, you get a better price in West Texas these days. Used to not be the case.
Yeah.
There's a premium there. You get a premium in the Gulf Coast, certainly, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, it all starts right with there. So like I said, to your point, well, okay, what is making this price move? And every single day there are multiple things. In fact, I don't know if you saw that in the book, but I go through probably listed at least 10 different things that could impact crude oil on any given day.
Yeah.
And these days, I would say today, it's certainly, well, the news about the SPR, mm-hmm. it's definitely, we're watching what's going on with China. And then every week it's the Fed. What's the Fed going to do?
Yeah.
Equities markets are sitting there going, are we going to raise rates? The inflation number comes out this week. Okay, what does that look like?
Yeah.
All of those wild things. I mean, it's just such an amalgam of potential influences. So those folks who are in the market on a daily basis trading or whatever, they've got to stay on top of news as it happens.
No, I did a radio interview last week for a WBAP here locally at like, I think 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. And they asked me, like, you know, where do you, I see the oil and gas going this year? And I said, well, the price of gasoline. And I said, you know, right now I think we're going to be higher, but we're at the mercy of what's going on with the Russian sanctions. And the fact that all these refineries, you know, and you mentioned Cushing's, that is what the world's largest holding yes. area, correct? Yes. And of all, so we got so many pipelines headed like so.
In and out.
Yeah, in and out. Yep. So when oil that I sell, that I put in my tanks, and this is just for individuals that may not know, oil comes out of the ground, it goes into my tanks, and then a big trucker comes, takes it, puts it in an even bigger tank in the Wichita Falls area, and then it pipelines it to Cushing's.
Right.
And so every small producer, and don't forget that, you know, over 50% of oil and gas is produced by small producers like myself. So Cushing, that's why Cushing is such an important place.
Sure.
And where things start yeah. at. It's just, you know, everything that goes on. But the other deal was, the other reason why I think it could go up is because all the refineries are running at 95% to 98%, and just one mechanical failure could shoot us up.
Oh, I love that you said that, because I was watching that all summer.
Okay.
Yeah, I love that you said that. That is so critical because, so for instance, last spring, March, April timeframe yeah. is when they do what's called turnaround. Yeah. They do their maintenance to get ready for the summer blends and the summer demand. And so it didn't happen, meaning I watched on a daily basis the what they call refinery utilization, to your point.
Yeah.
And well north of 90. I mean, and we've not even dipped. Even this past fall, when you should have had like kind of right after Labor Day, you normally see the turnaround is September, October. Didn't happen again. So you're exactly right. And exactly point on, I was sitting there going, here we go. It's not going to take much. Mm-hmm. We've had some small blips, but fortunately, right, there's not been a major refinery that all of a sudden shut down because they've been running so hard.
Yeah, knock on wood, we don't. And then you talked about market manipulations in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that we've gone up now, I think about 30 cents here in the Fort Worth area since we stopped. And that was a blatant market manipulation. And just kind of get in my conspiracy theory real quick is that, you know, we had a during the last election here 3 or 4 months ago, you know, we were shoving even more oil into the market to bring down the price of gasoline. But that's not price fixing by any means, is it? You know, I'm just saying.
It's okay. The SPR has always been a political tool. You call what you want.
Yeah.
You know, it was originally designed only to be used in times of war.
Yes.
It's a backstop of base fuel. Because it's not just crude. We have refined products in the SPR. But you're right. Every single president, whenever gasoline prices have gone up, kind of toyed with that idea, played with it. Biden's pulled more than anybody ever has. We're at I think we haven't been this low in almost 50 years in terms of what's stored. So that, get back to your point too about crude. So the marketplace there is waiting. When is the DOE going to come back into the marketplace? Now, they turned down some bids just last week. So they went out for a bid for about 3 million barrels a day, turned them down. So the market's waiting because, if the government gets in there, starts buying. The other interesting thing that happens, and this is just speaks to the market psychology. When the DOE would say, well, we're going to sell 60 million barrels out of the SPR. Right, the market reacts, oh my God, 60 million. But then, so this happens all the time. So in the marketplace, you get some piece of information like that and everybody reacts.
Yeah.
Well, then you let the dust settle, let the smoke clear. Okay, well, what's the real impact? Well, it turns out the most that the SPR can put into the market physically is 1 million barrels a day. Yeah. Now, that's not insignificant. I mean, you know, we consume anywhere from 16 to 18 million barrels a day, but the initial reaction is, oh, 60 million barrels. Holy cow, that's a lot of oil. Yeah. So the flip side of that is now when they go out to buy, they may say, well, we want to buy a package of 30 million barrels. The market's going to, oh my God, that's a lot of oil. They're only going to be able to pull it in at 1 million barrels a day. Yeah. So this idea that you see something happens, it goes, oh my gosh, you know, again, because the funny part is, the traders, that's their livelihood, right? Yeah. This is how they make money.
Yeah.
If they guess the market wrong, they're going to lose their shirt and they don't want to. Yeah. So there's immediate reaction. And then you got to say, whoa, time out, people. Let's sit back down. What's the real impact here? What's really going on? And so it's wild. That does, of course, add to this volatility I was talking about.
Yeah, you talk about the traders. All I can think of being terrible again is that movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. If I put you in at 25 and get you out at 40, you won't be happy, you know. But that's either there.
Oh, sure. or the other one, just Wall Street, the original one, you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
With greed them, yeah. is good. Greed Michael is Douglas. Good. Yeah, sure. Michael Douglas. Sure. And, sure. They didn't care who
the original Charlie Sheen, not this new guy we got, Charlie Sheen. The original Charlie. You know, he could have been almost a Tom Hanks kind of guy. You know, Tom Hanks was a comedian, mm-hmm. But then could do real serious roles. I mean, you look at Charlie Sheen. I mean, he did the goofy Hot Shots movies,
yes.
Major League, and then he goes and, you know, did he mirror his father's career a little bit? You know, what is it? Apocalypse Now and Platoon. Just a little maybe, but Platoon is just another really great movie. Yeah, it really is.
Sure.
But anyway, we'll transition. Let's transition to, let's talk about college. We're not going to talk about football, but let's talk about college and the great Texas Christian University here in Fort Worth. You have just started there. And, you know, to kind of get more of an idea, you've just started there. And it's at the TCU M.J. Neely School of Business.
Correct.
And the Ralph Lowe Energy Institute. I had to triple check.
It's a mouthful.
It's a lot. But I wanted to get it right. Because what you guys are doing are, I feel like, is blazing a new trail. You know, we had an opportunity kind of during our post or pre-production little chat. That, you know, what Dr. Morgan was able to do, what Dr. Ireland was able to continue, and now where Dr. Blunzer Ann is doing over there is just really, in my opinion, positioning TCU to be one of the premier places to go for a degree in energy.
I believe so.
Okay.
And so, I was at the previous university for 8.5 years, but I was watching. I was watching what was going on at TCU. I was.
Okay.
I was an adjunct in actually there in the fall of 2012, 2013. I taught an energy trading class in their MBA program.
Okay.
In 2013, at the end of that semester, it was a big billboard, you know, coming soon, the Ralph Lowe Energy Institute. And it was a building. I mean, I was just like, this is not a paper thing. This is a building.
Okay.
So I kind of watched the evolution over time. I've seen Dr. Blunzer there's a major trade show, NAEP.
Yes.
Right.
I'll be there next couple of weeks.
We'll be there as well.
Okay.
And then Meredith O'Brien, who's the director of the grad program. So I would always chat with them, but I would go out there. And a couple of years ago, I was sort of challenged with, okay, what should the energy programs at the University of Tulsa look like? And from the graduate perspective, I went right to their website. And I had made some proposals at the University of Tulsa, one of which was this idea that, okay, you're not ready to commit the time to get a graduate degree maybe right now. Well, what about taking a course or two? Mm-hmm. And then you build up towards it. And so I literally had pitched this idea of certificated programs. Yeah. I went out to the TCU Energy Institute website. Boom, there it was. I just sat there going, yep, they're doing it. So I've watched them from afar. I love what they're doing. In addition to the energy MBA, which is for working professionals, mm-hmm. They also have an interdisciplinary energy minor. Okay. So my own personal experience has been the industry loves students. So we had some flexibility where students could major in finance and energy management, economics and energy management, or accounting and energy management. And so they've got an interdisciplinary energy minor. And Dr. Blunzer and I got to look at it. She said might need some refreshing. Give it some more relevant energy content that it has. But you get a student that's got a finance degree or accounting degree or economics, even marketing management,
yeah.
and they've done this interdisciplinary minor. So they get the industry, they understand, they have the knowledge. And a big thing there is too, then they interview well. Yeah. You know, they understand the terminology, they understand some of the basics of the industry. So they've been doing the right things. And then just a few months ago, Dr. Blunzer hired Jen Engel, who's a media savvy person, a lot of experience in media. And they've just been blitzing out the energy industry stuff. I mean, Jen's on top of everything. I mean, they're out there on LinkedIn every day. So they're, just like I said, they know what they're doing. They're doing the right thing. They have a great product. Fort Worth.
Yeah.
The industry support, I mean, they have an executive advisory board with people across the spectrum of energy.
Yeah.
The funding, both the legacy donors as well as corporations. So from my perspective, when Dr. Blunzer reached out to me, I said, sure, I'd love to talk. And when she was talking about what her needs were, it really did fit because I'm kind of more on a micro scale mm-hmm. at the University of Tulsa doing what she's doing. Yeah. And so I knew coming down here that it would not be a question of resources.
Well, and let's talk about you and your way of teaching and what you're doing over there and how you relate with your students. and how your students have been able to use your teaching and are and what you've taught in the real world. Because I know that was something we kind of talked about a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, they would. I'm classified both at the University of Tulsa and at TCU as more of a clinical professor. And my title at TCU is actually Assistant Professor of Professional Practice in Energy.
That's a mouthful.
It is.
But it also, when I read it, because I wrote that down too. And most notes I've ever read, because there's a lot of mouthful stuff today. but I'm like, it almost seems like, okay, this man, and I read off your accolades, I'm like, assistant. I was almost like, you're the assistant to the essence, but yet this, and it's like, oh, by the way, he does almost everything. That's almost the way.
Well, I joke with my wife, I said I was going to legally change my name to Peter Piper. Then I could be Peter Piper, the assistant professor of professional practice in energy. But it is, it's you're considered a clinical professor. You teach things that you know firsthand, that you have experience in.
Yeah.
So to your point about teaching, my goal has always been, how can I help the students in front of me get a job in the energy industry? Yeah. What knowledge, and again, this is not, I don't make this decision by myself. I've always had industry professionals that say, well, we would love to see a student come to work for us who knows X, Y, and Z. Yeah. I try to stay relevant in terms of, I know what's going on now. I've been talking a lot about energy transition. And as you and I spoke about earlier, the realities of it versus what the perception is. Yeah. And so if a student were to go in an interview, and they were just, even at the base level, articulate in the terminology of the industry, they're able to talk to an EEP company or a midstream company and say, yes, I know what you do. Yeah. I can't walk in tomorrow and start, you know, solving all your problems, but I understand the terminology. I know what you do as an operator. So for me, that's the kind of thing. And when a student gets a job, I love that. Whether it's an internship or full-time job, then I feel as though I have done it. I've done my job.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned about students getting jobs. You know, right now we are at such a shortage of individuals that are wanting to go. Let me rephrase that. We're at a shortage of college students even wanting to go into college to work in the energy sector, let alone that we don't have the man force or the workforce, like you politically correct, the workforce to go out and take a ton of jobs that are out in the industry right now. And, you know, so I'm excited to see that you guys are working to motivate and get excitement back into these students that, hey, the oil and gas, or better yet, the energy sector is a great place to work for a long 30 plus year career. And that's something I think that you guys are doing.
Sure. Well, I mean, as you know, right, enthusiasm is contagious. Yeah. These and trust me, it's happened. You get students come in and their perception of things, they're anti-fossil fuel. Oh, I'm going to do green energy. And he's kind of like, are you going to really?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the jobs in those fields. And when you start to talk about how things work and when you bring around the reality of, again, you know, this idea of when you convince them or show them how much they themselves rely on fossil fuels. Yeah, okay, there's a transition, but it's still going to include fossil fuels. We're going to add other new technologies. We're going to add new forms of energy. One of the things I always do with students, and you do this, you should be doing this at universities anyhow, is this idea of critical thinking. In other words, you want them to question everything.
Yeah,
question. Don't take anything on face value. Question it. So, you know, we go through every form of energy. And I think that helps when you have a program where you're talking about all forms of energy, so they're exposed to it. And then they can start to gravitate. Oh, that sounds interesting to me. The other thing, and I know they do this at TCU, is you bring in industry professionals.
Yeah.
Talk about their jobs. The most impactful ones are the alums.
Yeah.
You know, I went through this program. This is what I do now. And I think that idea of educating them about what's real, what's not, but then showing them opportunities. One of the things I love to do is I will go out on Indeed.com.
Okay.
I'll find jobs that I believe these students will eventually be qualified for. And I send the link out. Like, okay, I want you to read this. You know, here's the duties and responsibilities. And then here are the qualifications you're looking for. Start them thinking about what's out there opportunity wise and whether or not they're qualified. Yep. Now, the funny thing was, one year I had a sophomore who wrote me this email and he said, what salary should I put in there? I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, well, you sent this thing out and I applied for it. I said, are you going to graduate tomorrow? oh, but it's just for their information.
Well, he's a go-getter.
But it's that kind of thing, right, that you're talking about is we have to show them, guys, these are your opportunities. Here's the salary. Here's where you can work. And so Indeed's been a big tool for them to at least start to understand, oh, okay, this sounds interesting to me. When they can do that, and then they come to you and you go, okay, if that's what you want to do, these are courses that you need to take. Yeah. This is what you need to do. You need to strive for an internship at one of these, you know, so you do start setting them on that path. And I just think that's sort of, we need to amplify that again. And I definitely see the opportunity at TCU.
I agree. You know, bringing it to my personal, my youngest brother, you know, none of us went to college. Well, my youngest brother did for chemical engineering. But I say, you know, I went to college not to be in the oil and gas industry. My father has been in it. And we were all, hey, we want to do a different path. And he was also that way. And then he did a weekend with ExxonMobil, and the North Face was there and talking about all how they use the petroleum products to make all the backpacking gear lightweight, strong, all these great things. And I'm an Eagle Scout. Both my brothers are, you know, so we love the outdoors and backpacking. And he was like, oh, wow, that's awesome. Okay, I can do this. I can. So, you know, so he went on and applied for the Exxon scholarship and all that. And he was excited about it. And again, it's been about 10 years. And that, you know, I think that I mentioned it already or before we start that, you know, he's 32 and he's one of the young guys out in the oil and gas industry now. Yeah. And we're just not finding those guys. And I know Ann mentioned that, you know, she's getting requests for jobs all the time.
Sure.
And so it shows that they're out there.
Yeah.
And so I'm just excited for what you guys are doing there at TCU. And I want to wish you guys nothing but good luck. And I know that the year started off great and is only going to continue to shoot up from there. So
Tom, I agree.
Thank y'all.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we're about out of time, but I just want to once again tell everybody out there to go check out Tom's book. It is Energy Trading and Hedging. This book focuses on energy products traded on the New York Mercantile Exchange, the NYMEX. These products have such a profound effect on the price of oil, not only in the United States, but across America. So it's a great way to look at things. Also, Tom, if people want to reach out to you, how can they find you and contact you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. My new email address at TCU is t.seng, S-E-N-G, okay, at tcu.edu.
Okay.
I'm also on LinkedIn. People want to look me up there.
Tom, S-E-N-G. Sing. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Well, that's it. All the time we got for this week. Tom, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure,
coming.
Ray. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And we'll see you next time on The Crude Truth.
This episode of The Crude Truth is brought to you by Complete Solids Control, Oil and Gas Workers Association, Sandstone Group, Air Compressor Solutions, Basin Fluids and the Fuel Pros, and Real News Communication Network.
The easiest way to start your own podcast and TV show? Real News Communications Network. Stand out from your competition. Produce streams of high-quality social media content. Become a thought leader in your industry. With RNCN, you get to be the host. We handle everything else. Tour one of our three locations in Dallas, Fort Worth, and The Colony. Call 972-402-6333 or visit launchashow.com to find out more.